we think in very short timescales. We think in the timescale of a human life, 100 years, or at most the timescale of our civilization, 5,000 years. But it's obvious that Earth has been profoundly shaped by cataclysms, by natural disaster, by natural events, the incredibly devastating things during that time that has both the potential to wipe out human culture and to erase the geological and archaeological record clean that those cultures ever existed. And I think that people are so opposed to it because we have lived in this stable period for the last 12,000 years. And so in our human brains, it's like, oh, the climate is. It's fine. We don't have these massive natural disasters that impact the entire planet or vast regions of the planet. But you just have to look at the kind of geological record of the Earth to see that we do, and that we have been living in an abnormal time because it's warm and stable. But the norm is cataclysm.
Michael, thanks for joining me today. First of all, congratulations on your YouTube channel, which I think goes by your name, Michael Button. While we're dealing with such issues, on your upcoming appearance in Scottsdale, Arizona, on the 5th to the 7th of November, and that's the Quest for Ancient Civilizations conference. And we'll be putting a link to that conference in the description of this video. I wish I could be there at that conference. It's organized by two friends of mine, Robert Dakota and Mike Collins, and they do an excellent job. So I think you're going to have a fantastic event there. And I encourage anybody who's tuning into this to, if you're in the US, to attend the conference. It's going to be absolutely brilliant. And subscribe to Michael's channel. You're a fresh new voice in this field. So I think that's where I want to begin. You are a fresh, new, and importantly, young voice in this field. And I have to say, as a bit of an old fart, being 75 years old, and having, cut my teeth in the 1950s and 1960s, and particularly the revolutionary period of the 1960s, I find a lot of today's youth supine, docile, unchallenging, and unwilling to ask questions. And that wasn't the case when I was a young man. We challenged everything, and I'm disappointed to see this trend in the youth today, where the voice of authority is just automatically accepted and never challenged. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that one of the important things you're doing is challenging that voice of authority and asking the questions that need to be asked.
Well, thank you, Graham. It's a huge honor to be speaking with you today. You're someone who's greatly inspired me over the years and have inspired millions of people around the world. So I'm very grateful to be speaking with you and to be speaking in front of your audience. So my name is Michael Button. I'm an ancient history graduate who decided to not continue pursuing a career in academia and instead start doing my own thing, go independent, and as you say, start a YouTube channel. Just to talk about these ideas that I love, really, regarding the dawn of civilization, the story of our species, the deep history of human intelligence, and things like that. And the reason I chose to do that was because it was during the course of my university study that I began to feel myself growing more and more opposed to the high-level perspective of human history, the timeline of our species that we were being taught. So about a year ago, I decided to start my YouTube channel, and it's been an incredible journey ever since then.
Was there any particular event, any particular moment where you thought, right, I'm going to start a channel now?
So I finished my degree about 4 years ago now. So it wasn't that I was in my degree and I was immediately like, I need to start my YouTube channel. There was moments during my degree when I started getting a spark that I wasn't happy with the kind of conventional narrative regarding history. In terms of actually starting the channel, it was more accumulation over years and years of having this seed in my brain that I wasn't happy with the kind of, the story of history that I'd been taught, and it never left me. And over the years after my YouTube channel, I started doing a few other things after my degree, I mean, but it never left me. It was always in my head. And so Yeah, roughly around a year ago, I decided I want to start speaking about this. I want to put my opinions across. I felt like I was in a relatively unique position to do so due to my academic background. So I wouldn't say there was necessarily a spark to start the YouTube channel. It was more a culmination of years of thinking about these ideas and not being completely happy with the perspective that I had been taught and that everyone pretty much is taught in the university system regarding our history.
Yeah, is your YouTube channel your only means of outreach at the moment, or do you have other social media outreach also?
I mean, I have all the social medias. I have Twitter X, I have Instagram, but the YouTube channel is the main thing. That's where I speak about these ideas in detail. So that's
We'll
my
link all your social media links in the description as well. In a few words, I mean, what do you hope to achieve with your channel? What's the plan? What's the ultimate objective with this outreach that you're doing? I mean, there's lots of ways that we can reach out with information in the modern world. Books are kind of falling away. People are not reading so much, and it seems that visual media is the strong way to communicate. What are you hoping to achieve with this project of yours?
Well, what I really want to get across is the fact that so much of human history, and especially the ancient stuff and the prehistoric stuff, is based on very fragmented bits of information that we construct narratives around, and these narratives are presented as facts. And it's fine to construct narratives around these small fragments of information that we have regarding our prehistoric past, but they should be presented as exactly that, as narratives rather than as fact, as truth. And I felt myself growing a little bit tired of the fact that we were taught that we knew everything about our ancient past and our prehistoric past, when I think that is not the case. I think there's such a chasm, such a kind of shadow, such a murky cloud of unknown when it comes to these topics that I didn't agree with the way that it has been presented by mainstream academia, because I feel like at the end of the day, none of us really know what happened deep in prehistory and before the start of civilization, before the invention of writing, and even after then. So I felt that I wanted to get across my opinions regarding our past, and I felt the best way to do that was to do it via a YouTube channel, because I felt that is, as you say, quite a modern medium, and it's the good way to get to people that necessarily perhaps haven't read books or other kind of sources of information. So I felt like that was a good way to do it, and that's kind of what I'm trying to achieve. I'm trying to encourage people to ask questions about our stories as a species, and yeah, that's what I'm trying to get across.
Is your material available on other platforms apart from YouTube, like Spotify, for example?
It's not, I do post my videos on Rumble as well, just as a kind of safe backup, but it's mainly YouTube for my stuff, yeah.
How important are visuals in your videos?
So it's quite important, mainly because I almost source what I'm saying with the visuals. So I show the papers, I highlight the evidence that I've got from the papers. And obviously, you can show ancient sites and stuff like that. And I've been to a few ancient sites, so I film them when I'm there. But I mean, obviously, what's more important is actually what I'm saying, but I try to, complement that with good visuals as
I
well.
suppose I'm just wondering whether there's a parallel track that's audio only. People listen to output in their cars. This is this the I'm finding these days my audio books are doing much better than my print books, and that's because people are making long car journeys, and it's an interesting diversion on a car journey. Have you thought about an audio-only version which doesn't depend on visuals?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, things like podcasts are absolutely booming at the moment. And I definitely hope to one day either kind of convert my video scripts into some sort of podcast audio form of media, or just to start something new along the line. Because as you say, that is definitely a way that we can get these ideas across.
Well, you're just really beginning in this field, and yet your channel already, after what a year, has become a meteoric success. What do you attribute the success of your channel to?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think partly I think I do it quite well. I tried my best
I
to,
think you do too.
I try my best to, condense the information into a digestible format and present it in a good way. But also mainly because I think there are so many people out there that aren't quite satisfied with the story of history that is presented by academia. And so many people are aware of these big inconsistencies and these massive questions and want different sources of information, want people that take a slightly different perspective, want people that come from a position of, we don't know, here's a possible answer, rather than, we know, here is the answer, this is the truth, you must believe it. And yeah. I feel like someone like myself, and of course someone like you, comes way more from the position of, many things could be possible. We sit in a place where we can't quite see the past. We don't know what happened in the past. And so here are some potential theories regarding what happened. And I think people gravitate towards that. People like that. People don't like being told exactly what to think and how to feel about history. So I think that is a big reason behind the success of what I do.
Yeah, and a big reason behind the failure of mainstream archaeology to communicate in an empathetic way with the public. The voices that I hear coming out of mainstream archaeology have no empathy at all for alternative ideas. They just sneer at them and spit upon them. And I think they're out of touch with the public mood right now, where people want to ask questions. And on that point, asking questions is a big part of what you do on your channel. Give me some examples of some of the questions that intrigue you and that you're asking, that you have asked, and that you will ask in the future.
Yeah, so I began, or I didn't begin, but the first videos that I did that started to gain traction were when I started asking this question regarding how long we have been a species and how that seems very opposed to this model we have of history, that nothing happened until effectively the Neolithic Revolution and the Holocene climate epoch, which is the idea is that that is what caused agriculture and thus civilization to develop. But it was during my university course that they announced that they discovered these Homo sapien remains in Morocco at the Jebel Ibrahim site, which had been dated to 315,000 years old or something like that. And
very important discovery, yeah.
Very important discovery. And I remember seeing that and thinking,
which reminds us, and it's worth making the point now, that you and I and others in the alternative sphere, we do also depend on archaeology. It's not that we're sneering at archaeology. It's a particular attitude that archaeology takes towards alternative points of view, which certainly bothers me. But I would be the first to say that I couldn't do any of my work without the work that archaeologists have done. And I believe that's the case with you as well. I mean, the Jebel Irhoud discovery is the result of the work of archaeologists. Let's give them credit where credit is due. And at the same time, let's point out the faults in the way that they're dealing, because I think there could be a synergy between the alternative and quote unquote mainstream points of view. You know, it doesn't have to be this sort of mutual hate campaign. It could be if that side did not constantly smear us and sneer at us, I think our reaction to them would be completely different. But the fact is, you know, we have a right of self-defense. And speaking personally, I've been attacked by archaeology consistently, continuously for more than 30 years. And it's very clear that technique on the part of archaeology isn't actually working.
Yeah, very much so. And you've always handled yourself with great grace, Graham, even though you've been attacked by many people, most of the time extremely unfairly. But I completely agree. We use archaeologists and historians' work all the time because we have to, because they do great work. They discover these things that we need to use to, you know, talk about these theories and pose these questions. But it is sad that I think it's possibly more of a very vocal minority rather than perhaps a broad brushstroke of all archaeologists that very much make themselves heard when they smear people like yourself. And that is sad, but I like to think that hopefully more and more archaeologists and mainstream historians will start to look at these questions and start to come on board with these ideas and start to delve into them
come on board, at least not to smear them and sneer at them. It's this snobbish, we know best, we know everything attitude of what you rightly say is a small faction of archaeologists. It's like fundamentalist archaeology. It's wrong even to call it mainstream archaeology. It's a small faction. The problem is that other archaeologists despite being aware that these people are often deceptive and dishonest, are circling the wagons around them and are not speaking out against them. And ultimately, that means that the rest of archaeology is complicit in what these individuals are doing.
Yeah, and I fundamentally disagree with that viewpoint, because I think at the end of the day, as I said earlier, none of us quite know what was going on in the deep past. The older you go as well, the harder it is for us to understand what could possibly have happened. So I think that the possibilities are much wider than what is conventionally accepted. So I do not understand when people viciously attack others for simply posing alternative points of view. It doesn't mean that the alternative points of view are necessarily correct, but I think they're worth, you know, raising. So
worth open-minded consideration. And yet these individuals react as though it's some kind of existential threat to them, something that must be fought tooth and nail, must be attacked and actually misrepresented. So often these attacks are straw man attacks. They say, you know, Hancock said this or Button said this, but actually neither I nor you did say that. They create a straw man and then attack that. And for members of the public who don't dive deeper and who don't look into it deeper, the words of these archaeologists may ring home, and they may think, oh, that's true, and they just accept it. I do actually regard it as an abuse of archaeological authority. Archaeologists are given a certain authority and status in our society, and they should not use that authority and status to undermine and attack ideas that they simply don't agree with. It can be done in a more decent, a more civil way, without the insults that constantly fly around. I note that Flint Dibble, who's one of the individuals who has consistently attacked my work over the years, and of course he's got every right to attack my work, and I don't take that away from him. What I object to is the smears and the sneers. And I noticed, let me see, what did he just say about you? Oh, he just said about you in a recent post about you, Michael Button, this dude keeps making shit up like a grifter. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that same language has been applied to me by Flint Dibble and by others who are associated with him. This sort of cheap, easy dismissal. This dude keeps making shit up like a grifter. And this constant use of the word grifter. Well, in this case, you know what it was about. It's about this recent evidence of potentially much greater antiquity for the human species. Were you making shit up? Were you being a grifter? How do you respond to this kind of smear being put out on social media against you by a man like Flint Dibble?
I found that absolutely bizarre, because for all the things he could have come at me for, that post that he did come at me for, I directly quoted the BBC article regarding this find word for word. So I'm not quite sure why he's calling me a grifter on that note, because I'm literally just reporting the news that is being reported by outlets such as the BBC and that has been announced by the Natural History Museum. So I'm not quite sure how that makes me a grifter in any way, but I think that's just the way they operate. And
it's part of their playbook. It's to use language like this to keep on applying it to people who they disagree with, to keep on calling them grifters, to never accept that the people they disagree with might actually be sincere and honest in our point of view, to always try to attach this notion of grifter, hoax, fraud to what we're doing. And this to me is a playbook. This is a deliberate strategy. It never really involves in-depth investigation or criticism of what we're saying. It's just this constant smearing. And that definitely started with archaeologists and their friends in social media. And I'm very clear that you and I and others on the alternative side are simply fighting back against these smear attacks. And they then represent our fight back as an attack upon them. It's a very bizarre situation that we're in at the moment. And it's doubly bizarre because it concerns the human past, our collective past as a human species. Could there be anything more important than that in understanding our collective future as a species?
Yeah, it's an odd way of operating. And I always say challenge me with ideas instead of insults, because I'm perfectly happy for people to, you know, disagree with my conclusions that I've drawn from evidence and say that actually I think this is that. That's perfectly fine. But to just randomly insult me as a person, I'm not quite sure where he's going with that, especially in regard to this discovery. I think it's mainly just because this is a discovery that's extremely disruptive to the worldview that people like Flint Dibble have, because obviously, if Homo sapiens are potentially 1 million years old, which is what this study strongly suggests, or at least strongly suggests that our lineage diverged that far back in time,
yeah,
that is an incredibly disruptive discovery for their worldview of history that they promote and that they defend so viciously. So I think it's more
it's fundamental, that, isn't it? I mean, what we're saying is that the defining characteristic of the human being is the ability to create civilization. That's what we do that other animal species don't do. And the notion of a lost civilization didn't quite fit when we thought that our species was just 50,000 years old or 40,000 years old, as we did back in the 1990s. There isn't enough room in that 40 or 50,000 years to lose a whole civilization. But then when you have Jebel Irhoud pushing the human species back to more than 300,000 years, and then when we consider Neanderthals and Denisovans and Homo naledi and Homo floresiensis, all the other different human species who have a right to claim humanity and who appear to have indulged in cultural activities, the canvas gets much wider and much broader, and we go back into deep time and have to consider the possibility that the ability that we pride ourselves for, the ability to create civilizations, was present in our ancestors tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even more than 500,000 years ago. And this just rips the rug out from under the feet of the rips the foundations, to use a better metaphor, from beneath the house of history that archaeologists have built.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing. It's because we have these models of history that we developed, or not we, but that, you know, archaeology or history developed
collectively as a society, and in that society, it is archaeologists who are specifically tasked with investigating and understanding the past. And that's why I talk about the abuse of archaeological power, because it's like a doctor telling you you must take this vaccine because it's better for you, without giving us any choice in the matter. And that's the same with archaeology. They say, we know best, this is how it is, and everything else is wrong. And this can't be a productive way to proceed in the future.
Exactly.
I'm looking for productive ways to proceed. I would rather cooperate with archaeologists than not. And the only thing that's barring that cooperation is the tendency of archaeologists to smear, to mount smear campaigns and to pour insults upon us. Inevitably, we have to react to that. And somehow this has to come. I'm not a pacifist. If people attack me, I am definitely going to hit back. Maybe I should become more, I don't know, more zen in my outlook. You're just beginning. You're going to face a lot of this. You're going to hear yourself called a grifter many, many times in the future. I see in a follow-up comment, he also called you a pseudoscientist. That's another one of their favorite labels, to try to just get rid of anybody without, they don't even have to do any hard work. They just apply the labels and hope that enough people will just see those labels and not think of anything else.
Yeah, they do that. And because then, exactly, then people immediately think, you know, Graham or Michael is a pseudoscientist who can't listen to anything they say. But
another thing they love is saying, these ideas have already been debunked. they constantly repeat that. These ideas have already been debunked. Why? Because somebody said that they had debunked the ideas. I'm sorry, that's not good enough. To debunk ideas, you have to go in depth into those ideas, not simply knee-jerk reject them.
Yeah, and I think the core problem is that many of these archaeologists still base their idea around history, around this worldview that was created, you know, 50 to 100 years ago, when, you know, the discipline really started, which is, you know, Homo sapiens only 30 to 50,000 years old. Climate then got warmer about 30,000 years later, civilization developed, blah, blah, blah. It makes perfect sense. But over the last, you know, half century, the evidence has come on so, so much since then, but we are still stuck clinging to this out of date worldview. But now that we know modern humans are 300,000 years old from fossil evidence, now that we have serious evidence that suggests our species diverged up to a million years ago, it starts to make absolutely no sense, in my view, that nothing happened, that we didn't really develop as a species technologically at all for, you know, 99.99% of our history. We lived in one exclusive form of life as a nomadic hunter-gatherer for, you know, if we've been around, let's take the fossil remains in Morocco. If we've been around for, we have been around for 300,000 years. To then say that nothing happened in terms of technological or any kind of development right up until the Neolithic Revolution 12,000 years ago doesn't make sense to me, especially as the argument is that it's the climate that led to that change. But we've lived through multiple warm periods in that time. And then if you take the divergence from a million years ago, then we've lived through something like 11 warm periods. And so it just cannot compete.
Which perhaps the most intriguing is the Eemian around 120,000 years ago, when the world was certainly for many thousands of years a much more hospitable place than it even is today.
Yep, perfectly stable climate. It lasted for longer than the Holocene has so far. And you think of how much we've achieved in the Holocene. And the Eemian, you know, is a few thousand years to go until we reach the length of the Eemian. And it was, yeah, warm and stable, as you say. And we'd already been around, even if you take the oldest fossil remains, for, you know, the best part of 200,000 years as an anatomically modern species. So what's to say we couldn't have achieved anything? What's to say sophisticated human culture couldn't have flourished in the Eemian? And we just don't see it because it's so long ago, because it's 120,000 years ago, that what are the chances we would see much to survive from that long? We have hardly any Homo sapien sites that are older than 100,000 years. So what are the chances we would see if a sophisticated human culture had flourished back then? It's hard to say that we would actually see anything at all.
Well, it's a problem of visibility, or specifically of archaeological visibility, at the point at which something becomes visible to archaeologists. And I think there's two aspects to that. One is the fact that only a tiny proportion of the Earth's surface has ever been investigated at all by archaeologists. Now, the fact that archaeologists haven't investigated the vast mass of the Earth's surface doesn't prove that there was a lost civilization. Of course, that doesn't prove anything. But when we look at the areas that haven't been investigated enough, for example, the Sahara Desert, for example, the Amazon rainforest, for example, the submerged continental shelves, which were flooded at the end of the last ice age. When we look at all of these, we're looking at areas that were actually habitable and perhaps the best real estate on Earth during the last ice age. And they're precisely the areas that archaeology should be deeply investigating, not shallowly investigating. They'll say, oh, we've scanned dozens of sites in the Sahara. I'm sorry, that's just not enough. The Sahara is way too big. What's needed is a very detailed investigation. Likewise with the Amazon rainforest, we're already puzzling new information is emerging. And likewise in the continental shelves, I'm pleased to see that the National Institute of Ocean Technology in India is following up dives that Ayan Santha did back in the late 1990s and early 2000s of Southeast India, looking at submerged structures there. Much more work needs to be done. Fortunately, some archaeologists are doing it, but we have huge areas of the world that were very attractive for human beings during the last ice age that simply have not been investigated at all. That's visibility problem number one. Visibility problem number two, you've already touched on, is the massive destruction that time brings. Anything that's in the intertidal zone, for example, during sea level rise in the first 5 meters, is going to be pounded by massive waves and just ground to dust and rubble very, very, very quickly. So there's the destructive effect of the ages. And then finally, and this is the point I'd like you to address, Michael, is the fact is that a hypothetical civilization of prehistory of the last ice age might not look anything like what we think a civilization should look like. I think this is part of when we go for archaeological visibility, archaeologists have a pair of binoculars in front of their eyes. And what they appear to be looking for, if they're going to accept any notion of a high civilization, what they appear to be looking for is something like us. Address that point. Should we be looking for something like us if we're looking for a lost civilization?
Well, that, I mean, this is the thing. Humans are so adaptable as a species, and we can live in so many different environments and progress in so many different ways that this idea that we're looking for exactly our civilization in the past, you know, skyscrapers and train tracks or whatever, you know, it's unlikely that humans would progress in the specific same way every single time. And human culture has the potential to flourish in so many different ways and to challenge to deal with different challenges in different ways. And I always think when I'm looking back in to say again the Eemian period is for example, like what's to say a human culture didn't flourish back then in a completely in a you know using materials that they just found in their environment, like the wood, the hide, the reeds, or anything they could find in their local environment, and just build a very sophisticated culture. They could easily have lived in a permanent settlement. There could be multiple permanent settlements that all connect, trade together. They could have had writing, which they wrote on some form of paper or anything. And all of that, it would be completely gone by, say, 10,000 years later, let alone 100,000 years later. And so these possibilities are, they don't seem to, people don't seem to agree that that is a possibility. And I really don't understand that. I think that when we look at our past, we should surely except that multiple possibilities are viable. And yeah, I don't understand why anything like this is dismissed.
Yeah, and has become the subject of such heated conversations, particularly online. I mean, I realize that there is a toxic element to the whole online world, but it has become particularly toxic around this field of prehistory. I mean, I don't regard myself as a conspiracy theorist. And by the way, conspiracy theorist is another one of those put downs that archaeologists use. Oh, it's just a conspiracy theory. I don't regard myself as a conspiracy theorist, but I do sometimes wonder what's going on. It seems that whenever one touches on the issue of a cataclysm that brought a former civilization to an end, which I've inevitably had to do in my book since Fingerprints of the Gods that was published in 1995, and that's when these attacks really began. The moment that you consider the possibility that some kind of cataclysm, was it an impact of multiple fragments of a disintegrating comet? That's my favorite scenario at the moment, but it's not the only one. Professor Robert Schoch at Boston University attributes the onset of the Younger Dryas cataclysmic climate episode to changes in solar activity. The reason why it happened is not clear. We may have our favorite points of view, and I think the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis is the strongest, but I'm open to many other hypotheses as well that consider this bizarre climate episode called the Younger Dryas that set in about 12,800 years ago and ended about 11,600 years ago. And whatever caused it, it was horrendously cataclysmic. And I think that's the point where we become a species with amnesia, where we lose track, we lose our memory of what went before. But it bothers me that it's the moment one starts talking about a cataclysm bringing an end to a former civilization, that this is what brings the swarm of bees down upon you. Why is there this fear of talking about cataclysms? I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but does somebody know that what goes around comes around? That certainly in terms of the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, we do pass through the Taurid meteor stream twice a year, and the Taurid meteor stream contains dozens of enormous objects, which are the remnants of a fragmented comet. Is it possible that somebody knows something that we don't know, or is it just that it's kind of considered bad taste to talk about cataclysms? Why do they provoke such a reaction from the mainstream?
I think it's because we think in very short timescales. We think in the timescale of a human life, 100 years, or at most the timescale of our civilization, you know, 5,000 years. But it's obvious that Earth has been profoundly shaped by cataclysms, by natural disaster, by natural events, and has done throughout the history of our species. Like, as we say, we've been around for so long, and the Earth has been subject to incredibly devastating things during that time that has both the potential to wipe out human culture and to erase the geological and archaeological record clean that those cultures ever existed. And I think that people are so opposed to it because we have lived in this stable period for the last 12,000 years. And so in our human brains, it's like, oh, the climate is fine. We don't have these massive natural disasters that impact the entire planet or vast regions of the planet. But you just have to look at the kind of geological record of the Earth to see that we do, and that we have been living in an abnormal time because it's warm and stable. But the norm is cataclysm and massive changes in temperature and huge events that can completely disrupt the climate and human populations on the Earth. And then when you look at the Younger Dryas, which is probably the most recent one that you could define as a kind of cataclysmic climate event, the climate was getting warm, the climate was getting stable, civilization could have, you know, begun, flourished, or already existed. And then we have this dramatic event, we have this horrific event for whoever was living there. And as you say, no matter what it is that caused it, that can be debated, and we haven't fully established that yet. But the fact is, it was a completely horrific climate shift that would have been devastating for human culture in whatever form it was that lived on the planet at that time, and stayed devastating for, you know, the best part of a thousand years, I think. So I don't understand why because we debate what caused the Younger Dryas, that kind of shoves away the fact that the Younger Dryas was a very dramatic event and definitely had the potential to cause severe devastation. So I don't know. I'm not sure exactly where I land on the debate. I think there's very good merits to the Comet Research Group, and I've looked into their work a bit. I did a small video on that. I didn't do too much of a deep dive, but I did a little bit of an inquiry into the potential of a comet striking 12,000 years ago. And there's obviously some interesting kind of mythological evidence, if you want to call it that, for such a thing occurring. But yeah, I don't fall into any camp particularly, but I think it definitely...
While you're looking at the different camps, do take a look at Robert Schoch's excellent work on the involvement, the possible involvement of the sun in the Younger Dryas events. You know, Robert Schoch is another person, a professor of geology at Boston University, who's stuck his neck out and taken the slings and arrows of hatred that have been projected at him by, again, this small group of archaeologists who seem to want to own the past. Robert has stuck his neck out and taken those risks and put his reputation on the line and carried on doing excellent geological work. And again, I feel this is worth recognizing. So I hope you'll take a look into Robert's take on the Younger Dryas as well.
Yeah, I will. And as you say, that's another thing that can cause massive disruption on this planet. And there are so many different factors that we just do not appreciate what we've been through as a species, what we know we have been through, because we know that our species is at least 300,000 years old. We know our species is now potentially, you know, up to a million years old when we diverged. So we have been through some incredible things. And it's both testament to how good we are as survivors, but it's also testament to how much could have happened, how many stories, how many human lives, how many cultures potentially flourished, rose and fell in our deep past. And the history of the Earth is so brutal. The fact that we made it through, what would we really expect that nothing happened and that we just kept going up and that we didn't have any setbacks, that nothing pushed us back? It doesn't make sense to me. And yeah, I mean, Dr. Robert Schoch is a very, very interesting guy. I've obviously looked into his work on the Sphinx with John Anthony West, and very interesting. That ties into the Green Sahara that you were talking about earlier, which is a bizarre thing that's never made sense to me. That, you know,
well, I'm just planning. I think we were talking off air about that, but I'm actually about to take a big trip right across the Sahara. Because the fact of the matter is that the Sahara was green and fertile for several thousand years before ancient Egypt appears as an archaeologically recognizable civilization along the banks of the Nile. You know, I have to wonder whether some of the mystery of the origins of ancient Egyptian civilization may lie in the Sahara Desert, which we know for sure had lakes, had rivers, had grasslands, had savanna, was a nurturing and positive environment for thousands of years, certainly from 10, 11,000 years ago down to about 7 or 6,000 years ago. And then suddenly ancient Egypt appears as a fully developed pre-dynastic Egypt, as a fully developed civilization on the banks of the Nile. And you know, it's the background to these things. It's the same with Mesopotamia. When we go there, ancient Sumer actually doesn't just come out of nothing. There is a background to that as well. I'm interested in looking at all of that. Just to round up on the cataclysm issue, I've noticed that when I talk about the Younger Dryas, which was undoubtedly a massive climate change event that took place between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, whatever caused it. When I talk about that, quite often on YouTube will add a warning, telling viewers that, you know, this contains counterfactual information about climate. So it seems that maybe the reason that certain archaeologists are just so dismissive of the role of cataclysms in the human story is because the role of those cataclysms, to some extent, undermines the climate change ideology being entirely caused by human beings, which is now very much in the air. In fact, it's one of those things that you can hardly question without having a swarm of attacks descending upon you. Now, I'm not saying that there is no climate change. There is climate change today, for sure. It's minor by comparison with what happened during the Younger Dryas, but there is climate change today. And I think that the broader factors that cause climate change need to be taken into account as well as human activity. That doesn't mean that I think we're doing things right as human beings. I think we should love and nurture and care for our planet. I think we should do everything right by our planet, because our planet has been doing right by us. This is our home, this is our garden in the universe, this is where we live, where our future is, where our children and our grandchildren will grow up. We have to take care of it, nurture it, love it, look after it, not pollute it, not destroy it. But the climate change narrative is using fear to make people afraid, and that is counterproductive. If we want human beings to behave in a better way towards the planet, it's not creating a false narrative about how we're the cause of everything. It's understanding that we could behave in a much better way towards the planet, and we don't need fear to drive us. That we just need intelligence and love and respect for this planet that has given us life.
Yeah, I mean, both things can be true, right? Like, yes, we should definitely treat the planet with more respect, and we should try and clean up our act, for sure. But also, this buys into the whole kind of arrogance almost of the modern view. We think we know everything that happened in the past. We think we are the biggest, you know, influencer on the climate, but we're clearly not. You just have to look at the temperature record of the last 300,000 years or last million years. And I got similar warnings on some of my videos where I talk about these topics, and I'm literally just discussing the temperature graphs and saying, yeah, look, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down, and we're currently up. We don't want to go down. And yet I still get flagged for, you know, disrupting the climate change narrative, because we do not want it to get cold. Global warming is bad, but global cooling, dramatic global cooling, would be devastating for our civilization, and has potentially been devastating for civilizations that occurred in the past.
Yeah. No, it's slightly sinister that there are more and more subjects in the world today which one becomes almost afraid to talk about because of the massive hostile negative reaction that will be produced. We seem to be entering blindfold into a kind of Orwellian world. You know, George Orwell really got it right back in 1984. And that is what's happening. It's wearing different clothes. It doesn't look exactly like the 1984 world that he imagined. But when you get down to the roots of it, thought control, mind control, thought crime, all of these things are actually happening in our society today. And it's so weird that one of those thought crimes is to even consider the possibility that archaeology might have missed a whole civilization in the human record. Michael, I'm sorry, I'm getting into a bit of a rant here. So I just want to move on. What are your plans for the future? And do you have any travel bucket lists that you're intending to fulfill in the years ahead?
Yeah, so I mean, my plans for the near future is to keep doing what I'm doing, keep pumping out videos, keep asking these questions. I really hope that this channel provides me with the opportunity to start to travel to these ancient sites, as you mentioned, because now that I'm, you know, getting some traction, I feel like I can justify the going, you know, abroad and going to all these sites and, you know, making content about them, giving my views about them. So I really hope that that is the kind of place I can take it. In terms of my bucket list for where I want to go, I am planning to go to Egypt early next year. So that's great. Number one of the bucket list, definitely to Giza.
your audience is going to have a treat to look forward to.
I hope so. I hope so. I hope I can, you know, because I mean, obviously, Egypt's been covered a lot by lots of people, including yourself. So I don't want to, you know, just like rehash old stuff. But
well, the point of view is, as I said at the beginning, you're bringing a fresh, new perspective to these ideas, and that's just absolutely what's needed right now.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just going to, you know, go there, see it for myself mainly, but also convey my opinions on because I haven't really touched Egypt in my videos. I did one video about the Sahara, but I've because I, you know, it's almost the best place, and I want to kind of save it until I'm ready. So yeah, that's number one on the bucket list, and I might make it a 2-week trip and go to the south of the country as well, but I haven't quite decided yet. So that's number one on the bucket list. Number two is
check with me before you go. I can give you some suggestions.
I'd love that. I'd love that. Thank you, Graham. Number two is a big battle between Turkey, ancient Anatolia, and South America. I always switch between which one I want to go to. I'll probably end up going to Turkey first, just for convenience, because obviously us in the UK, we can get to Turkey a little
also,
bit.
Also, it's the heart of a huge mystery at the moment. I mean, what is being revealed in Turkey around the Taş Teple civilization, which is the name that Turkish archaeologists are giving to what is now clearly a civilization of which Göbekli Tepe was a part, a civilization that extends down into the Jordan Valley, that extends into Syria, that extends as far as Cyprus. The heart of this matter is in Turkey, is in Anatolia, where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers rise that run down into Mesopotamia, the home of supposedly the world's first high civilization, ancient Sumer. So I'd highly recommend Turkey as a very important point on your bucket list.
Yeah, definitely. I really want to go there. And I think that, just quickly on that point, I think that Taş Teple and Göbekli Tepe and all these sites will be classified as civilization one day. I think it's just going to take, you know, a few years or just people's thinking to update, because there is so much evidence that, you know, they're all connected. This monumental architecture, shared symbolic thinking, therefore probably shared, you know, spiritual thinking. And yeah, I mean, it has a lot. It's just
in many senses, Michael, the lost civilization that we're looking for has actually been found.
It's already been
right
found
there in Turkey. And Göbekli Tepe isn't the whole story. It's part of the story.
And I think me, as well as many other people, that was the big smoking gun that really shifted my viewpoint and then led me to start looking into all this other stuff. Because I remember seeing that and I remember thinking, why is this not considered civilization? Look at some of the civilizations we do consider civilizations in, you know, post 3000 BC. Many of them don't tick every single part of the checklist, but because they're at the right date, they're considered civilization. So it seems to me the only reason Taş Teple isn't considered civilization is purely because of this extremely uncomfortable date. But I think that with time, thinking will update on that. And I look forward to it. And yeah, definitely really want to go there. And then, as I mentioned, I want to go to South America. I really want to see Sacsayhuaman, where I know you've just been. I really want to see Ollantaytambo.
Not only that, having just been to Peru, the main focus of the visit that Santh and I just made to Peru wasn't Sacsayhuaman, although exciting and extraordinary things are happening there, which I'm going to be documenting. But really intriguing on Peru are the coastal pyramid cities, Banduria, Caral, Penico, Aspero. These are, if we go for the orthodox dates of the Giza pyramids, these gigantic pyramids in Peru are older than those. They're hitting close to 5,000 years old, possibly even more. And again, all tribute to the work of archaeologist Ruth Shady Solis, who has single-handedly, but now with a good team around her, been responsible for the revelation and excavation of these sites, which are completely changing human history. I remember a time when it used to be said, oh, there could be no connection of any kind between the pyramids of Egypt and the pyramids of the Americas, because the pyramids of the Americas are much younger. Well, no, sorry, here again, another turn of the archaeologist's spade has revealed that old saw was not correct, and that there are older pyramids in the Americas. So that's another area I'd recommend you bring your fresh new perspective to and take a look at.
Definitely. And there's just so much mystery in South America, so much mystery. It's almost unbelievable how little we know, I think, in comparison to some other parts of the world. It's incredible. So yeah, I definitely want to visit all those sites, but that would be a big trip. But hopefully one day.
It's a big trip, but you've started on the road. You've got an excellent channel out there. You're asking thought-provoking questions, and you're getting people who might not be interested in these subjects at all to take an interest in them. And you're also getting the flack from the archaeological lobby. So welcome to the club, Michael. I'll remind our viewers again that you are speaking in the United States, 5th to the 7th of November, and that's at the Quest for the Lost Civilizations Conference, and it's going to be held in Scottsdale, Arizona, in the US. We will put the link in the description of this video, and I hope those who are in the US or able to get to the US will attend that conference, because as well as you, there's a lot of other excellent speakers, and it's going to be a really fantastic event. I'm very glad for you that you've been invited to speak there, and I look forward to seeing hopefully the broadcast of what you have to say afterwards. I wish I could join you, but I'm too busy writing a new book right now.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited both for your new book and also for the conference. I am really looking forward to meeting so many cool people, both the speakers and also everyone that's going to come along. It's going to be a really exciting event. And super looking forward to it. It's around Christmas time, I think. So Christmas in Arizona should be great.
Well, not quite Christmas. Fifth.
Not quite. Fifth. That's Christmas time.
Hang on. Scottsdale, Arizona. It's not November. It's December. Let me get this right. It's fifth. Yeah. Sorry. I may have announced it incorrectly at the beginning of.
I think you said December. Maybe not.
Did
maybe.
I may have said November, you know. We get confused at my great age. But anyway, it's the Quest for Ancient Civilizations, Scottsdale, Arizona, 5th to the 7th of December, 2025. And the link will be in the description under this video. Michael, thank you very much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. And I wish you joy on your path in the future.
Thank you, Graham. As I said, it's a great honor to speak with you. You've inspired me a lot, so thank you so much. And I hope everyone enjoyed it.
I'm sure that many people will find this discussion of interest. And I intend to have more discussions like this with more people in the future. This might even be the beginning of a Graham Hancock podcast. Who knows?
You should. Would love to see it.
If so, it'll have to wait until I finish the new book, but somewhere down the line.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, well, you're a great interviewer, Graham, and you're a great man. So the people would love to see something like that. I'm absolutely certain.
Thank you for those kind words, Michael. I really appreciate it. Very good to talk to you. Be well.
You too, Graham. Thank you.